This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Welcome to episode 60 of the Rex Chapman Show with my super dope homeboy from the Lextown, Josh Hopkins. What up, Josh?
Not much, Rex. How are things in Brooklyn?
Everything's good. Are you in Austin these days? It looks like you are.
I am. I'm in Austin. Yeah. Starting to cool off here. Feeling really nice. Things are going well in Austin. It's a good place to be. I've got to come up and see you in Brooklyn. I promise you that's going to happen in the next few months.
Okay.
Year's over, I'm coming.
It's nice. It's getting fall. Today was like 65, 70. Beautiful. Just beautiful.
I better get there now because I don't like the cold.
Episode 60, Josh. I don't know a single number 60 in sports. I can't think of one. None.
And it's the only one I can think of is Otto Graham.
Otto Graham. That's a good 60, pull.
But that's
a great tough pull. I would go like Dr. J 60, yep. Russell Westbrook.
That's 60. How I would do it as well.
Right.
60s tough. But how about us? We've left the 50s in our, we're in our podcast lives. We're in our into the 60s.
Yeah. You know, you would think that we would be better at it by now.
Yeah.
Nope.
I would say, though, it's interesting that we would regress. Most people don't do that when they put in the hours, but somehow
that is true. Somehow we'll get to 10,000 hours and be way worse.
And also, we won't get to 10,000 hours, which is
true.
Yeah.
Oh, goodness. Book club. Josh, did you have a chance to read anything this week?
This week, I was really busy. I had a lot of sleep to catch up on, and there's some like TV stuff. So no, I couldn't get to it this week. I feel like I let our listeners down, but I can't add anything in. What about you?
No, super hungry all week. Super hungry.
Can't read when you're hungry.
No, I just big week of eating for me. I just couldn't, every time I'd think, I should read that, I got hungry. I just ate. So no, I didn't read anything.
That's nobody's fault, Rex. When you're hungry, you're hungry.
That's what I try to say.
Well, you should.
Thanks. That's been book club. Josh, let's talk about our guest this week a little bit. A little bit of a departure for us. We normally have sports-related folks on to some degree, but we have a guest who's sort of like from the royal family of film and politics.
Yes. Yeah.
We have Ben Mankiewicz. And explain a little bit about the Mankiewicz family, if you can.
I mean, it would be hard to bear the burden of being a Mankiewicz. Let's see, his father, huge Washington journalist. His brother is
Josh Mankiewicz.
Josh, what is? I already like him.
Dateline and all that.
Dateline,
stuff.
Yeah, and well respected and loved. His great grandfather, no.
His grandfather
wrote a little movie some people think is pretty good, Citizen Kane. That's decent. Not bad. That's not decent. Not bad. And a lot of other stuff. And his great uncle wrote, I think he won 4 Oscars writing and directing. And the Mankiewicz name will get you in the door there in Hollywood. I can tell you that. And he hasn't needed it, our guest.
We have Turner Classic Movie, CBS News, Sunday Morning, and TCM Podcast, The Plot Thickens and Big Lie. host, we have Ben Mankiewicz. Ben, welcome, buddy.
Oh, The Big Lie, right. That's my cousin's, John Mankiewicz's Audible series on the Blacklist. And I forgot that I do narrate part of that. Yes, that is okay. That is indeed true. I was like, what's The Big Lie? And I'm like, oh, that's right. But that's my cousin, John Mankiewicz's show. Everybody should check it out. It's a narrative Audible podcast with John Hamm. It's good. John Slattery. It's good. Apparently, John Hamm and John Slattery are in everything together. Because they're Mad Men and they're in Fletch together, and they did The Big Lie together too. So,
man, I'm a fan. It's good to meet you. I've I followed you on Twitter, and I think that's how a lot of us know one another now, it seems. But I'm just delighted that you're here. I want to get to the movie Mank and your grandfather that was nominated for an Academy Award, all that stuff. You grew up in Washington. At what age did you become aware of your family history? Did you ever see your grandfather's Oscar in a glass case or anything?
I don't remember it as a kid, but my dad had it. Like it belonged to my father. My grandfather, Herman Mankiewicz, died in 1953. So he died well before I was born. And my dad was such a big deal in politics in DC that I didn't. So I was aware of my family's history, but it meant nothing. The Hollywood part of it. It was just like, yeah, that's what my dad's father did. And I talked to Uncle Joe, Joe Mankiewicz, who won four Oscars. In two back-to-back years, writing and directing back-to-back years, it'll never happen again.
Can you just back up a second before you answer this question and kind of talk about your grandfather and his brother and, you know, about how your family is Hollywood royalty.
Yeah. So by the way, that crazy phrase, Hollywood royalty, which gets thrown around. So I grew up in DC. I came to LA for like a couple of weeks in the summer when I was seven, meaningless. And then I came back, second visit ever to LA in 1988, like over like Christmas break, I think, or maybe it was the summer, something. Like, anyway, I come and I stay with my cousin, John, the guy who's a screenwriter, and he's got this narrative Audible podcast out now. So I stay with him and another cousin, Tim. We go to a party, like a Hollywood party. Like, oh, we'll go to, it doesn't mean anything to me. I'm 21. Doesn't matter. I'm like, okay, great. I'm a dork. I don't like think parties are cool. I don't know what to say to people. And so I go to the party and I get introduced to my cousin, although he's a Mankiewicz, it's through his mom. So he's named Tim Davis. So he doesn't have the last name. So we get to the party and he introduces me to the host. And he's like, you know, whatever, you know, Josh, this is my cousin, Ben Mankiewicz. And he goes, from the Mankiewicz. And I'm like, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. And he clicks his heels together and takes a little bow and goes, Hollywood royalty. Right. And I swear to God, I look behind me like, oh my God, Steven Spielberg's son must be here. Right. Or something. Like it didn't dawn on me that this was for me. It was just stupid. Wow. So that was really That's a weird great. Thing to get. I was like, I mean, it was way too late for me to, of course, I knew my family had written, I mean, my grandfather had written Citizen Kane and my Uncle Joe about Eve, Letter to Three Wives. Cleopatra nearly wrecked his career and his reputation. So, you know, we had this fun thing. Wow. And one of my other cousins write about it. He's written a book about it called Competing with Idiots, about the relationship between Joe and Herman. Herman was about 10 years older than Joe. And Herman wrote Citizen Kane, considered by many the greatest film ever. And Joe directed Cleopatra in 1963, considered by many the worst film ever. So it's like, it's not, it's so stupid, but that was but Joe was far more successful than Herman. Joe has those four Oscars. So anyway, it took me a while, given that my dad was a big deal. My dad was Bobby Kennedy's press secretary and ran George McGovern's campaign. He was president of NPR. Before that, he beat the Nazis. He was first Latin American director of the Peace Corps, you know, and a great, and the smartest guy in any room ever. So the notion that we should be making somehow like a bigger fuss about some other Mankiewicz was foreign to me. I was like, this is the smartest man in the world, my father. Like there's no, I don't. And then I stumble into this job, which is crazy, where I, you know, talk about the movies that my grandfather, my uncle and hundreds of other artists, thousands of other artists made. So it's pretty cool how it worked out, but it took me a bit to develop a full appreciation for it. I wasn't hostile to it. It just didn't, it wasn't important to me until well into my 20s.
I was just reading about, I believe it was a quote from, no, not your grandfather, it's Joe. right?
My grandfather, like that's yeah, my great uncle is Joe. I'm Herman.
Your great uncle Joe talking about, you know, coming out to LA to visit Joe and being at this party, much like you were at, and turning, and all the stars were there. And he just couldn't get over it. You know, Humphrey Bogart and whoever, who all was there. And then he had promised to be always in academics and never go down the path of his older brother and get into this Hollywood stuff. And he turned around and there was his professor from Columbia who he had promised. And he was mortified to see him there. And the professor said, "What are you doing here?" And he said, "What are you doing here?" And the professor said, "Well, I'm writing Hollywood for Hollywood now." And so he felt much better about it.
Yeah, this was like his literature professor, the guy who would have, the one person that Joe would have been mortified to say, like, "Oh, I'm getting a paycheck in Hollywood. I'm so sorry." And then that guy's like, "Yeah, I'm working on a screenplay for Columbia." Like, yeah. So right. All right, I guess we're okay.
Did you feel pressure? Did you feel pressure at any time?
I feel it now. I feel it all the time. It's just sort of like I don't expect anybody to, you know,
but it's weird.
Hug, but it's
weird.
Definitely there. Yeah.
It's weird though that you say that. I mean, you didn't really have a full appreciation for how massive the appeal was until you were, you know, maybe 20, 21. Did you feel pressure before that?
I felt pressure just from being my father's son. I mean, I'm telling you, they're like everyone who worked with my father, everybody at NPR, all those, you know, great NPR correspondents, Cokie Roberts, and Nina Totenberg. I mean, there's a good chance, I won't put words in their mouth, but they would say the smartest person they knew was my father. And everybody called my father for help and in anything, whether it was help writing something or whether it was help navigating a difficult situation or how to turn the, you know, bad press into good press. I mean, whatever the problem was. And so I just, you know, it took me a long time to think, you know what, I'm not going to be as smart, as clever as him. And that's okay. You can still have a like rich life. And he never put an ounce of pressure on me ever. I love sports. I wanted to be a sports broadcaster. He was like, "Let's go. Let's do that." He was great, but he couldn't help it. It's the nature of, and my brother is 12 years older, Dateline correspondent, Josh Mankiewicz, right. He's so good. And he's so funny and so charming and everybody loves him. So, you know, and he's the only other, me and we're two siblings. And so he's just growing up in like his shadow. You just think, you know, you can't beat him. And then you find your own way. Again, I don't think it's worthy of sympathy, but it is totally true that you just feel this pressure. And almost every child of a successful Mankiewicz has definitely felt it. Joe Mankiewicz, because Joe was not a good father. My father was a great father. Joe Mankiewicz was not a good father. His kids, Tom and Chris, hard, and his daughter, Alexandra, wow. hard to be his son.
Wow.
And daughter. Yeah.
Man, so your brother Josh is 12 years older, you said?
12 years old. He looks much older, but he's just 12 years old.
But that's so interesting, the dynamics of your grandfathers.
Yeah.
They were 10 years apart.
Close to the same. And Joe, like me, grew up idolizing his big brother. That's why he came out to LA. Because Herman came out first, was writing title cards for silent movies, and then eventually sound. He was the highest paid screenwriter in Hollywood for a while. I mean, that didn't make you the richest guy, close to the richest guy in Hollywood, but they made a good living. They had nice houses.
What made him do that? Did he know somebody out there?
You could come out, like you could really find your own way. I don't know what, he got offered a job in New York to come out and write titles. Cause he was a theater critic for the New Yorker. He'd been a correspondent for the Chicago Tribune in Berlin, covering foreign affairs, but for a long time he covered theater. He was a theater critic, which he thought was a noble profession. Theater critic, noble profession. Writing movies, sellout. Right. So there was all this. He is self-loathing, defined Herman.
Right.
Defined it. And could have defined Joe. Joe just figured out how to get past it. So, but then it gets there and the checks are ridiculous. Right. He was like, this crazy. They never had money like this. You know, I mean, his father, Franz, very disapproving man, my great grandfather. And he was a teacher, a professor. But I mean, like at CCNY, like that was what you did. You know, he's one of those parents who there've been a lot of books written about them lately, but I mean, he would say to Herman, like, you'd come home with a 97 on a test. And he would be like, where's the other 3 points? Not well done. So Herman never got comfortable with it. He wrote these great things and he always thought this is, you know, popcorn for the masses. This isn't substantive. You know, he'd written a play. It didn't do well. You know, this was being a writer. If you wrote the great American novel, if you were a playwright, but even again, if you were a theater critic, that was worthy. This was nonsense. And he beat himself up and drank himself and got himself fired all the time. And if you saw Mank, that was a pretty accurate portrayal of what kind of guy he was. A fun drunk. Everybody liked him. He wasn't a mean drunk, except to people who maybe deserved to be mean to, you know, but he was, but he hated himself. He hated what he, you know, and he was so, which is tragic because you want to go back in time and say like, no, man, people love these movies. This mattered. It does matter what you're doing. This is an art that counts, but Joe was comfortable with it. And then, so Joe, I idolized my brother. I still do, but Joe, you know, came out idolizing Herman, and then Herman kind of disintegrated, you know, and kept getting fired and needed money. He was always lending money too. But Joe then came to resent Herman because Joe had all this great success, but everybody was still like, Herman's the funniest guy, right? Herman's the genius. Even if he's kind of a failed genius, he's the genius. Wow. And Joe's like, no, I got 4 Oscars. I'm the genius. I figured it out, man. You know? So they, but my brother and I do not have that. We're very close. So that's fortunate.
I paraphrase.
He taught me how to be on TV. He taught me, you know, everything important. I basically mostly learned from my brother.
I paraphrase, but isn't there a quote from Herman? I believe he was writing back to Joe and saying, "You got to get out here. There's millions to be made, and everyone I'm competing with is an idiot."
You got to remember the last line. So it was to Ben Hecht, not to Joe, but it could have been to Joe. He cabled the great writer Ben Hecht, and he says, get out here as soon as you can. There's millions to be made. Everyone else is an idiot. Don't let this get around. And sure enough, Ben Hecht came out and, you know, made millions.
Steph Curry's record-breaking three-pointer, Jason Tatum's buzzer-beating alley-oop, Ja Morant's poster dunk. NBA Top Shot is where the greatest moments from NBA history are turned into officially licensed digital collectibles. NBA Top Shot has evolved trading cards by making it easier to buy, sell, and collect by removing the hassle of grading, shoeboxes, and shipping fees. You can buy or sell moments in a few clicks and access them at any time on your phone or computer. Your collection is always at your fingertips. Start collecting Top Shot moments in any way you want. Collect rookie moments from future stars like Evan Mobley and Cade Cunningham. Collect throwback moments from former NBA stars like Shaq and Allen Iverson. Or collect moments from your favorite team to gain access to exclusive perks. Grab your starter pack today and Top Shot will give you $20 back to start your collection and pick up some of your favorite moments in the marketplace. Go to about.nbatopshot.com/bballnews and get in the game today.
You started, you know, you said you'd learned everything from your brother. I love that. You started your career though as a TV reporter in Charleston, yeah, South Carolina, and then Miami. Did it come naturally to you? Did you have to work at it? It's tough. Like it's very different. I can be interviewed all day long. I've done that my whole life. Doing the interviewing and being in front of a camera and all that stuff is very different.
It is. It's different. I don't know whether it's hard, but it's a skill, right? It's just reading a teleprompter is a skill. I mean, at Turner Classic Movies, we've brought in some really big, enormously talented actors at various times to where they have to like read something on the prompter and they cannot do it. I mean, they sound like they've never, right, ever, but then they'll win an Oscar. I mean, they can be in front of a camera, but they cannot read. So it's like a dumb skill. But that said, mostly you just get used to it. And I was very shy. I still am instinctively shy. So I get past it, but I think without my brother, I never would have done it. I mean, I didn't really know what to do, but here was this, he'd worked in TV as a producer. He interned at ABC in the summer. And then, you know, he gets a job as a producer and then works his way on the air. He of course started in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. Right. But right. So eventually I sort of decided, and my first thought was I'd do sports. You know, I mean that, you know, I was the guy who loves, I was the kid who loved sports. So did my dad, not as my brother, less so. So that's, and then I got to be 26 and I went to journalism school. And then I was like, I guess I should do this, but it was terrifying. It was, and I was bad, but then you know, you do it every day. I mean, it's like a baseball season. You know, one of the great things about being a TV reporter is like, however lousy, however awful your live shot is, however bad your piece is, you got another one the next day. Right. You can, you know, so the beauty is you come in clean and fresh every day with a chance. And I started to get better and get a little more comfortable, but it is foreign. It is foreign. Yeah. Every time those camera comes on, every time they turn on lights. Well, I love podcasts and doing interviews, just audio, because, you know, I mean, you can wear a hat, you don't care. There's no, as soon as you put makeup right. on and they turn the lights and they adjust and you got to, it changes the dynamic. It changes things. No question.
So in the early 90s, one of the biggest stars in the world was singer George Michael. I was playing in Washington for the Washington Bullets at the time. And the big star there locally was George Michael of the George Michael Sports Machine. And you worked for George?
Well, not only did I work for George, but I saw you play at the Capitol Center. I don't know. It must have been, you know, because that's when. So when were you, remember offhand when you were with the Bullets?
I was there like 92 to 90, 91 to 95, yeah, something like that.
Because I worked at, so for George, I was in, that would have been like 87, 88. Yeah. And then the next year I worked for Glenn Brenner, another broadcaster in DC. But then I got out of college. And I worked for 2 years at the ABC affiliate, which Frank Herzog was the anchor there. And I was, paid. I was a producer. And that's when I saw you play. Cause I know I was there working.
You but and those like teams, 300 other people.
Oh man. So that's the thing I learned about groupies there, because I'd go out.
And did we have them?
Some Bullets game. No, that's the crazy thing. And the team would be, you know, 23 and 59 or 21 and 61. And they were so, forgive me, Rex. I mean, they weren't interesting either. They weren't a fun losing team. It was just kind of sad. And I loved the Bulls, right? Loved. All my, the June 1978 beating the Sonics to win the NBA title, one of the happiest days of my life, 11 years old. It was just joy, right? Wow. And so, and I get there and I'd be like, it's amazing because they're finished the game. They're terrible. They just lost to the Pacers 119 to 91. Right. Game was over halfway through the second quarter. And there are these girls lined up after the game. They're there to meet Liddell Echols. Like, how's that possible? Right. You know, but they are. That's it. You know,
that's great.
It's so true. It's so good, too. Oh, my gosh. When did you know, you probably could have gone different directions, politics, you know, sports, TV. What was it that, you know, sort of gravitated you toward what you ended up doing and, you know, what you're doing now?
A lot of decisions that worked out in my life were, this sounds like a joke, but I mean, they were so dumb and they were motivated by the wrong thing. I mean, then you make the best of it. Right.
Right.
I mean, I didn't go to college at NYU. I went to Tufts because Tufts was, I don't know, four spots better in a ranking. And I was embarrassed by the schools I didn't get into. So I thought, I better go to Tufts, but really I was scared of New York. I could have gone, if I got into Columbia, I would have gone. I got rejected. So but NYU, like, you know, in the Village and no campus. And I was like, oh, I can't do it. I'm terrified. So I made a bad decision. Right. But there was like a moment where I thought, and maybe this is for being a Mankiewicz and maybe thinking that spending my life watching the Pacers beat the crap out of the Bullets or caring that making, you know, do I want to spend my life saying that the Giants beat the Padres 5-4 when it really doesn't matter if the Padres beat the Giants 5-4, that doesn't have anything to do with the world. And it was almost that period of my life lasted about 4 weeks. But in that period of time, I was like, I can't do sports. It's not serious enough. It's not important enough. It doesn't, you know, there's problems in the world, and my dad made a difference, and my brother's a journalist and he's making a difference, and what am I going to do? I'm just going to sit around here and I'm going to go to college basketball. My goal was to go to, you know, again, to, you know, be at an NCAA tournament and cover it. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, now I would say, yeah, great. Do that. It's fine. Covering sports is great. It's noble. It's fine. Right. But I made the decision not to. So I went into news and sort of willed myself to care about it and willed myself to try and care about politics as much as my dad. That worked. Like I tricked myself into caring and knowing and understanding politics. So that was the good thing that came out of that decision.
That's so amazing. I mean, I'm sitting here because I'm trying to picture myself. I'm almost the exact opposite. I was just only, it was only basketball for a long, I mean, till my 30s and maybe even till just a few years ago when I thought, oh no, there are other things out here that
you were great at it. I mean, it was like, it was clear. I mean, it wasn't just that you knew you could maybe be a professional at it, which of course turned out you could, but you know, if I would have been that, I didn't feel like I was that good at anything. So it was, I wanted to find something I was good at. I mean, even TV, I was like, I won't be as good as my brother. You know,
you grew up in DC though. What was it that just freaked you out about New York?
Oh, New York was, you know, DC, first of all, wherever you grow up, you can handle. Right. You think you've got a fix on it. But New York just intimidated me. I mean, I was scared. Obviously. I mean, I wish I'd gone to NYU only because it would have been bolder, because I would have grabbed. I'm sure. I don't know. I wouldn't have entered the film school. I would have ended up there. I'm pretty confident. Mm. I mean, I had a great girlfriend at Tufts. I would be foolish to change it. And I met some good guys, but I forget that I went there. Like it doesn't, it's not like when they call to ask for money and I'm like, I don't want to be rude, but there's no chance. It's not part of anything that I care about myself. Wow. I don't, nothing definitive except the wonderful girlfriend. Wow. Other than that, I don't. So I just wish I'd challenged myself. That's all. And not been afraid. You know, you never look back on things. I'm so glad I was afraid. Yeah. You know, yeah. That was cool when I was scared. Yeah.
It can work out for you though.
Everything worked out. Everything worked out.
You hosted a lot of shows on the Young Turks network.
Jenk and I created the Young Turks. Well, I mean, he was a little head start because he'd done it at Local Access in DC. But
how did that materialize?
We became friends in Miami. We hired him. I was hosting the show in Miami. That was luck too.
What's it meant for your career though? I mean, it's pretty.
Well, first of all, the show in Miami changed my career, but and that's where I met Cenk. So in many ways it changed my life, but we hired him to be on the air. Cenk's the main host of Young Turks. And we brought him in. He wanted to be on the air. He was so bad. Oh my God. It was the worst. So bad. So bad. But he was clever and he was bold and different. And we agreed on, he was a Republican then, but we agreed on everything. And so we'd have the only argument we'd have, I'd be like, I don't think you're a Republican. I just don't. You can say you're a Republican, but I don't. How? I go, I know you're embarrassed by Strom Thurmond. You're embarrassed by Jesse Helms. Like, you think these guys are awful. And he's like, yeah, so what? And he's like, and then in the 2000 election, it was like, this Bush guy, he's too dumb to vote for. I can't do it. he's like, he's dumb. He can't be dumb and be president. You can't. And that sort of began this sort of genesis that he's had. But and then so we connected and became really, really, really close. And then the station shut down. We both moved to LA. I moved like 3 months ahead of him. And like, we went to get drinks one night and he's like, yeah, I'm thinking of starting that public access show I had and doing it as like a radio show, Sirius satellite radio. We mailed them the tapes. Like, we would do a show and put it in the mail to Sirius satellite radio. Wow. And he was like, and I was like, he's like, I don't know. I kind of wish I had a partner. I was like, well, I wish I had something to do like that. And then we're like, right, so we're obviously just going to do this together. Right. And he was like, yeah, okay, great. That's it. And then,
it was good. That's so great. You're the lead anchor for Turner Classic Movies. How'd that come about and how are you so good at it?
Well, thanks. Very nice of you to say. I mean, the 10,000 hours is part of it. I mean, I'd been on television 9 years when I got the job. So, I was fairly comfortable, but people used to say, in the first 3 or 4 years I'm there, they're like, oh, you're so much better than when you started. And I was been like, you know, it's my worst compliment ever. You know, I've been on TV for 10 years at that point. I've been working for 15 years. And what you mean is that you got used to me, right? Like, you know, TCM fans, and they're the best. And I don't say that because it's the thing you're supposed to say. They're, you know, it's the only channel that has fans who consider the channel a defining part of their lives. There's nobody in, you've not, no, there's no normal person in the world, no functioning person in the world who goes, oh, I don't know, man, I love ABC. Right. Oh, you know, yeah. Oh boy. You know, I mean, you like, you, nobody says, oh, I love Showtime, right? You like shows on Showtime, right? Yeah. Nobody goes, yeah, what do you like to do? I just like to go home and watch Stars, right? It's not, that's not a real thing. So, but TCM like defines people. The, I mean, obviously yeah. It's these moves. So anyway, so I got, you know, I mean, I was just unbelievably fortunate. I auditioned for every show on the planet. They had decided to hire a second host. I failed at like 150, 160 auditions in LA. After that show in Miami shut down, moved to LA. I got nothing. And then they had an audition at TCM, and it was more than a, where you just go and try to impress in an empty room. They thought at that point, this new host they hired for the weekends after Robert Osborne is the main host, that it would be a conversation. So they had like 10 people come in, and they had to screen a couple of movies, Kurosawa's Seven Samurai and the American remake, The Magnificent Seven by John Sturges. So then just discuss them. And so I just discussed them. Right. And I watched them and discussed them, and you got a chance to be yourself and be a little clever and funny. And they kept bringing me back. They were like, okay, now you play the expert. Now you play the host. And I was in every session, and I was like, oh, I'm doing, this is good. Like, this is, and it was like a 3-hour audition. So there was time to get past the opening jitters.
Isn't that fun when you start feeling, you know, that energy coming back at you when you bombed so much.
It was thrilling. I mean, it was one of the best feelings I've ever had. And then the time they called me back, like 2 months later, a month later, they'd given up on that. And it was just, come here, read a teleprompter. We can't do that. It's too hard to book. We're just going to do this. But I knew how to read a teleprompter. I'd been a local anchor, you know, and whatever, I got to do that. And then the guy, I did the audition. I read a script for the Cary Grant movie, The Bishop's Wife, David Niven, Loretta Young. And I finished the, you know, 2-minute intro, minute and a half. I didn't change a word. I was terrified and finished. And the guy goes, well, this isn't your first barbecue. And I was like, well, yeah, I know how to read aloud. You know, and then like weird stuff. I like telling the story because it's so stupid. So I go home and I do the audition. My girlfriend at the time says, you know, how'd it go? I go, I think it went pretty well. I mean, I just came in, I read, they seemed to like it. The guy made some weird comment about barbecue, and I went home, you know? And then I said, I tell you what, let's turn on TCM. And if a Mankiewicz had anything to do with what is on right now, and obviously that's unlikely, then I'll definitely get the job. And I'm not going to be stupid and superstitious and say that I'm not going to get it if it's not a Mankiewicz, and I still might get it. But if it is, I'm definitely going to get it. And she's like, all right, I go, let's see, turn it on. And the movie is The Barefoot Contessa with Humphrey Bogart, Ava Gardner, written and directed by Joe Mankiewicz. And
I was like, come on.
Right. I don't know. And I was like, you know, this is like, there's no TV guide. The only way you find out what's on, you have to turn it on. In 2003, it was the spring or summer, early summer, 2003. And it was Barefoot. And I was like, wow, I wish I believed that this meant anything, because this is a great moment. And then I end up, whatever, a couple months later, I got the job. So,
it's great.
And that was 19 years ago.
Is film your favorite art form?
Yeah. Cenk, son, we do a podcast together, like an old school. It's called Old School. So the idea of what the Young Turks was going to be before sort of politics totally took it over. It was, you know, we were going to talk about nonsense for half the show and politics for half the show. But then the Iraq War happened and we had to do away with the nonsense hour. So we do this podcast once a week. It's like a salute to the Young Turks as we imagined it would have been in 2003. And this is like a year ago. And he said to me, okay, here's the question. And it was somebody else on too. He goes, you have to give up movies or music for the rest of your life. Which one do you keep? Right. And I did that, made that sound. I went, oof. Right. And he says, you know, it's gotta be movies. And I was like, yeah, definitely. And then I was like, I think I might have to keep music. And I don't even know that much about music, and I don't play. But man, when you need music, or you, it's just, it's too, the thought that there wouldn't, that I couldn't play another Bruce Springsteen song was like too painful to face. So if the question is, what's my favorite art form? I mean, I watch musicians and I don't even know what they're doing, but I'm so blown away. I mean, I think the dumbest things, I watch it, I see live music and I'm like, how does the drummer know what to do? Like, he gets it right every time. It's every so time. Amazing, you know, every time. And then so yeah, I mean, with, it's a tough, music and movies are in a, they're in a pretty fierce battle.
Well, we're on a pod here. You talked about your pod earlier. Talk a little bit about The Plot Thickens. It's received rave reviews. Complicated storytelling at its finest. I'd love to know a little bit more about your perspective. Yeah.
So I wanted to do a podcast TCM for a long time, but you know, I had like an idea that I would do an interview show because there aren't enough of those. we need more. I love interviewing people like you do. It's fun, right? I mean, I got good at it. It took a while. And I was friendly with Peter Bogdanovich, the director, through the job. And Peter was such a wonderful man and complicated, honest about his own foibles and mistakes and very human. And I was like, you know, he had interviewed all these great directors, wrote a book called Who the Devil Made It with all the, you know, 20 of the finest directors ever, Orson Welles, who he was close friends with, and, you know, John Ford, Howard Hawks. The book is called Who the Devil Made It. It's a quote from Howard Hawks. When you watch a film, you ought to know who the devil made it, Hawks said, right? That the director's stamp ought to be on it, right? So I thought, well, I'll talk to Peter and he'll talk about different directors and it'll be a good TCM podcast. And then pretty quickly, Angela Carone, who heads our podcast, was like, yeah, I think the podcast should be about Peter. And then she presented why. And I was like, oh, you're smarter than I am. Yeah, that's better. And so that became season one of The Plot Thickens. It was Peter Bogdanovich talking about his life, which is, you know, so filled with, and, you know, he was the hottest director, was compared to Orson Welles with his second movie, Last Picture Show. And he was dazzling. And then it all came crashing down. And some of it was his fault, arrogance. And then some of it was unfathomable tragedy. And then he came back and then he screwed up again, you know, by suing a studio over something that didn't, over Bruce Springsteen, over whether the studio replaced Bruce Springsteen's music with Bob Seger, because a new studio head came in and it was cheaper. Nothing wrong with Bob Seger, but Peter's vision was Bruce Springsteen. And that was for Mask. And then Peter screwed up again and then fell apart again. And then, but yet he was this living link to classic Hollywood. So it was a really compelling story. And then we did two more seasons, The Devil's Candy season two, and about the making of Bonfire with the Vanities, Lucille Ball, which was amazing for season three. We had all this great tape that we got to tell Lucy's story and stuff people really did not know about her. And then, I mean, all before the movie comes out and the doc. So it was weird that Lucy had an unreal year in 2021. and then this year, later this month, October 25th, season four, Pam Grier.
And Pam, fantastic. I love
Pam Grier, somebody. And this, so we get to tell the story of Hollywood in the middle of the new Hollywood in the early 70s, mid 70s. And we get to tell the story of Black exploitation. And we get to tell Pam's story, which, independent of all that she represents, she's the, you know, first female action hero in the history of the movies. And she and that, white or black. And we also get to, and then she became the biggest Black exploitation star. You know, right now, I think people think, you know, they think Shaft and they'll think Richard Roundtree, but the biggest Black exploitation star was Pam, and all the complicated things that term means, what it means, means different things to different people. So we get to examine that and Pam. And Pam is fun and crazy and wonderful and just is impossible to root for. So that's, I think, seven episodes and they're good. I put my voice to two of them today. So, episodes 5 and 6. So we're still, you know, as everything, we're crashing it on the air, but
like most people, she's one of my early first crushes, you know.
Well, she is our,
and
she,
Pam Grier, and she follows me on Twitter, which is one of my big thrills.
That's cool. Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah, she's the best. It's hard. I mean, you'd have a, you hang out with her now, you'd still have a crush on her at 73. She's still unbelievably
charming. I know I would. Yeah. Ben, what is it? We just talked about, you know, if you had to do away with one forever, film or music, what is it about pods now? You know, Josh listens to his pods all the time. My son, it's like, if he goes for a run, instead of listening to music, he listens to pods. Why? What is it about the pods that are so fascinating to people?
Well, I think we managed to find a manner of storytelling that we hadn't tapped into. So we found something different, you know. Obviously we were in the middle of, I don't even know whether you can call it a golden age anymore of television. This is how television is going to be
right.
for the foreseeable future. Yeah. And, you know, and the writing is so, there's so much depth to the writing. It's so complicated. It's so nuanced. You know, I mean, as great as the shows that you and I grew up with, right. obviously TV is better now, right? I mean, the acting is better. The writing yeah. is better. Everything is better. It's more real. It's raw. But podcast, this sort of narrative storytelling, to say nothing of all the interesting interviews. I mean, you know, I mean, like, thank goodness for podcasts. I get to right. talk to Rex Chapman, like, it's, you know, but it's, I'm not trying to just, I mean, that's super cool
yeah.
to me. Like no, I was, you know, you. And your story is a pretty compelling story. Oh. Right. Oh. I mean, I love when people try to like make fun of your past, right. They think, gotcha. I'm like, yeah, and man, he knows. Yeah. He knows.
I was there. I did it.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And you realize this is sort of his life is a celebration of what you can get past. Like that's part of the freaking charm, idiots. Yeah, like that's yeah, part of what's yeah. great about it and yeah. inspiring. So, you know, you get exposed to all these great stories and all this new manner of storytelling and not being able to see something and to use the sense to use your hearing to imagine it. Right. I mean, it's like this little I mean, first of all, it's like old time radio. I don't want to pretend like
right. that.
Yes. But for us, people who've grown up in this era of thinking, well, I can listen to something or I can read something or I can see here it is. It is taking reading and television and sort of mashing them together in an yeah. interesting way. And I think that has grabbed us. I hope it continues to. I think it yeah. will. I mean, I can't imagine they're going to be this many forever. But as long as people are willing to do it for very little money, you know, you know, Joe Rogan gets all the money,
right?
Then I think it'll work. I mean, I badly want it to go on. I want to do more, you know, and I still yeah. want to have that. I still want that interview show. But I love doing the Plasticans, and I love that people are into it. Oh, and also, you know, it is narrow casting, right? I mean, we're already at that stage with television, right? I mean, there is no broadcasting. I mean, you know, there was that show, Jonathan Silverman did the show called The Single Guy. It's like, yeah. this is an example. It was on like Thursday nights on NBC for two seasons, maybe three. Ernest Borgnine was in the show. He played like the doorman, I think. But it was on like after The Cosby Show, or I don't remember the era. It was on after Cheers. I don't know when. It was on in that NBC lineup, either at 8:30 or 9:30. It was at the bottom of the hour show. And it got canceled after 2 years. Because it only had 20 million viewers, right? And, you know, or 18 million, whatever it was. Right. Like, it would be the number one show in the country. It would be the biggest hit in the world right now if it had that many. But now you don't have, you find a million people, right? Good. You're set, right? Yeah. And then we figured out ways to try to monetize that to those people. Right. So you can find what you love. So, you know, when you kids or when Josh goes out and goes for a run, he's finding the thing that really suits him, like music. So I think that's really appealing that your choices aren't to listen to, you don't have to listen to news, right? You can listen to whatever. You're a movie fan, you'll find it with the plot thickens, right? Right. There's just a real opportunity to find something that gets you going, that you're passionate about.
I love
by the way, just real quick, it turns out that what everyone is passionate about is people murdering other people.
This podcast is brought to you by Branded Bills, the best place online for premium headwear and apparel. Branded Bills has hundreds of designs available, including our popular state collection, where you can show your pride with hats, shirts, hoodies, and more for all 50 states. Are you a company looking to brand your business? Branded Bills also offers custom apparel options that can meet your brand standards with fast turnaround and shipping. To shop or learn more, visit brandedbills.com today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yeah, well, it's the parallels where your great grandfather looked down on this art form of, you know, film and didn't want. And then even your grandfather didn't really think he was doing something benefiting society.
No, it is my grandfather. That's who didn't. Yeah. My great grandfather, he didn't like any of it. Right? But my grandfather, Herman. Yeah. Mank. He's Mank.
And then it turns out, you know, he helped create this incredible art form and was making such beautiful art. And you come around and you're like, God, I don't know what I'm going to do. I can't live up to this name. And in this new medium, what people make fun of, by the way, like, oh yeah, that's what we need, another podcast. But you're doing it in such a way, this long form, that it's definitely art. And
yes.
Yeah, no, it is. It is. I couldn't. I mean, also there's something else that's great about it. It's the collaborative part of it, right? I mean, that's one of the, you know, which is the forgotten part that we don't even do enough justice to at TCN that makes movies great, right? That it's this amazing collaborative art. And but these podcasts are, I mean, I go over the scripts and I write now a little bit and that's good. And I host it and I do the main interviews. Obviously I did these, you know, 3 days of interviews with Pam and 5 days of interviews with Peter. And that's the form of the backbone. But I mean, sometimes I'll put my voice to the podcast and I'll say to Angela, yeah, I don't think this transition doesn't sound right. Sounds a little abrupt, sounds a little hacky and awkward. Yeah. And she's like, yeah, it does. But wait till the sound mixer, wait till our editor, right. Mike Vulgaris gets a hold of it. And then sure enough, you're like, oh my God, it's beautiful. I'm weeping, right? Right. At this thing he created.
Yeah.
And that's true of the CBS Sunday Morning pieces that I do, which is a great thing. And I was told when I came in, it's an editor driven show. And, you know, you work with a producer and you craft the script and you think you got a good story about someone and then it airs and you get your breath taken away because of what the editor did, you know?
Right.
So I love being part of that.
Ben, a couple years ago, November 2020, Mank was released and telling the story of your grandfather, co-writing Citizen Kane. How do you think that movie stacked up with the reality?
Well, first of all, you're talking to a Mankiewicz, so I'm going to correct you on the co-writing part.
Okay.
He wrote Citizen Kane.
Orson
Welles contributed a little. I mean, so that's one of the things.
I'm blaming that on JT, our producer.
That's one of the things that's one of the things that it drives me crazy because Herman wrote that screenplay. I mean, it's beaten into my head by my father. and that's what Mank, I think, makes pretty clear. Orson Welles truncated it some but the debate over who wrote the screenplay obfuscates what should be obvious, which is that it's Orson Welles' movie. He directed it. He changed the way directing, it changed what directors could imagine they could do with a film. He produced it by sheer force of will against incredible headwinds and producing it in every sense of it. He made it happen. And he delivered this unbelievable performance. So yeah, I got it. He didn't write it, but it's his movie. And let's not have an argument over who wrote it turn into, you know, he wanted credit for everything and he had an ego and he had a contract that called for that. So I get it, but it's his movie and it's probably the greatest movie ever, but my grandfather wrote it. So how did it stack up? I think pretty well. I don't know. I never knew my grandfather, but I started crying like within 40 seconds of that movie, because one, I wanted my dad to be alive to have seen it because it was exactly how my father described his father. Like not all the events happened. There was no California governor's race that defined Herman's break with studio heads that was made up, but politics mattered a lot. So it was a metaphor for that. Politics mattered to him. But who he was, the sort of the that guy that Gary Oldman inhabited, that was just how my father, the manner in which he was drunk, the manner in which he was funny, the manner in which he was thoughtful and smart and thought about really big things, the manner that he hated himself for all those things, not caring about money, gambling, that he gave me. he was a huge gambler, and he didn't care if he had money. I mean, if he lost $28,000 in 1937, he'd be like, well, all right, I guess I better get a job. You know, it didn't, you know, he also lent money. I mean, he borrowed money from Joe, and then he'd literally borrow money from Joe and then he'd lend it to friends. I think that might have made Joe a little irritated. Yeah.
Skirting.
Yeah, that's right. That was constant. But he used to, the famous story about my grandfather's that if he was like some guy who was down on his luck and really needed $1,000, or if he, some guy who, you know, had to, you know, a family and he'd lost $1,000 at the track or something like that, or a medical condition, something that caused, Herman would be like, he'd lend him the money and he'd be like, and here's $1,000 and here's $1,000 more, because the $1,000 is just going to get you even. You got to have $1,000. You got to have another $1,000 to sort of get yourself together. And then he'd forget who owed him because he didn't care. And that's very appealing. All that stuff makes him sound sort of heroic. And I think if he hadn't been drunk all the time, he would have been heroic.
Some say he was the funniest man in the world. Did you ever see that?
No, he died at 53. So he died at 56 in 1953.
Oh my gosh.
Sports fans will appreciate this line. It's from my uncle Don, who's John Mankiewicz's father, my father's brother. Don was a writer, Oscar nominated himself for the Susan Hayward film, I Want to Live, but wrote the trial episode of Star Trek, wrote a lot of pilots, like wrote the pilot for Ironside. I think Marcus Welby too. But Don, on March 5th, 1953, Herman Mankiewicz dies at 56, basically drank himself to death. I mean, I think it was kidney failure ultimately, but it was all a big picture. It was drinking. And so he dies. And then later that day, the family learns that Joseph Stalin died. And then Herman says, Don says to my father, Frank, his younger brother, he goes, well, so Joseph Stalin died today too. So at least we split the doubleheader. it's a great line. Yeah.
So great.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Ben, before we ask our guest this, and I'm particularly interested to know, we ask everyone two questions. First, what is your favorite movie? Do you have one? Can you even do that?
There's three movies that come into my head right away. It could change by the day. Four movies. I can't construct a list of the top anything without including Casablanca. I've seen it more than any other movie. It makes me cry every time, sometimes at different spots. Obviously I have to include a Jennifer Lopez film. Out of Sight is a movie that gets me every time.
Soderbergh.
Yeah. With Clooney, and that was my introduction to Don Cheadle. And I was like, who's this guy? What is happening here? Like, you know, and Clooney is, come on. He's charming. He's good.
Yeah.
Right. You know,
he's a movie star.
Jennifer Lopez proved then, right. He's a movie star. And Jennifer Lopez proved that, you know, if she did this all the time, she's great in that. And Ving Rhames and Steve Zahn is so funny in it. Albert Brooks, Nancy Allen. This is great. And Soderbergh, so I love that movie. I saw the movie in Miami when I was working there, and I came out of the theater and I thought, well, if this is how I felt at the end of every movie, all I would do, I would go to a movie every night. Like I couldn't, it was a feeling that I would chase forever. And then a couple of movies from 1957, which I think is Hollywood's best year. Stanley Kubrick's war picture, World War One picture, Paths of Glory, with Kirk Douglas, who produced it too, which is, I think, the best war movie ever made, which will break your heart. It's a great movie. Wow. And it feels like you've watched a 4-hour epic. It's 90 minutes. Like it's really?
You gotta watch it.
It's a gut punch straight through. It's an amazing, amazing movie. And then Sweet Smell of Success, Burt Lancaster and Tony Curtis, also 1957. I love media movies. I just thought of media. So All the President's Men. Gotta go in it too. And One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And then I go on.
Now you go on and on.
Yeah, go on and on. Yeah.
Yeah. Cuckoo's Nest is my, my favorite. I mean, yeah, it's my favorite piece of art.
Yeah, right. That's a totally legit thing to say. Who I just was talking to somebody on Twitter, one of the people who follows us all on Twitter. Who was that? Who loves Cuckoo's Nest too? Anyway, many people, but it's incredibly moving, Cuckoo's Nest. But 1967 to 1976, those 10 years in American movies is the greatest 10-year run ever.
Wow.
You know, I mean, there were great stuff after that. It's just 77, Star Wars comes, and that changes it just feels like a different era starts in 77.
Yeah. Have you seen anything lately that you liked?
I went to the Telluride Film Festival, which TCM sponsors. So we go every year, which is a great, unbelievable perk. You can't believe that's in America. Not that I don't think America is beautiful. I do, but it's just like, that's here. It's right here.
Yeah.
Like, you know,
right.
And for all the talk about, you know, all these other beautiful places, I'm like, the best they can do is tie this, you know, so I saw, you know, I saw stuff that was good, but nothing really. I mean, best thing I saw recently was Confess Fletch.
I haven't watched it. I saw it and people were saying, I really liked it.
I don't want to you should not go in thinking, oh, great. You know, Ben Magwood said it's going to be great. It's going to be hilarious. Like, just, you know, balance yourself out. Like, if you love the original, as I do, and can quote Chevy Chase, by the way, coming on the TCM cruise, November 12th through 17th.
Fantastic.
Yeah. So, so I'm going to talk to Chevy. And so I thought that was awesome. Like, I got to see that, but I loved it, man. I thought John Hamm was delightful and it was fun and funny and stupid and all the right ways. I thought it was great. I think people should see it, but I just don't want to. Yeah. I don't want them expecting too much, but that's only because I want you to enjoy it.
Good.
And then the second question we always ask is front row center for any musical band or comedian or speaker or athlete, front row center, dead or alive. Who do you go see?
I mean, I get to live this. I mean, I've seen Bruce Springsteen 40 times and I'd still take Bruce. I can't wait till he's back on tour. It just every time it reaches me, it's there's nothing better than seeing nothing better than seeing Bruce and the E Street Band together.
You said you referenced it a couple of times that I dislike crying. I just do. There are songs that I listen to that I know are going to make me cry. There are movies that what is that? You know, you said you've seen him 40. What is that, you know, it just moves you? What is it?
I think that you have to think about being moved, that it is it's not the crying. The crying is the result of being moved. Right. So it is the willingness to accept whatever that powerful emotion that builds up in you. And I just feel instantly connected. It's like this. It's like taking a drug that reminds you of the things that are important to you. Like I do that. And I'm going to think about my father and I'm going to think about how lucky I am to have my brother and how lucky I am to have my wife and how my kid is the best kid on the planet, which of course she is. My dogs were great. And the dead dogs are great. The dogs that are still alive. It's just, you know, and you just feel fortunate. Or if things are bad, I imagine I would think like, okay, these are the things I got to get past these things that are plaguing me. And so, you know, it's just I mean, I suppose also sometimes it could be sad. It can be sad. There are definitely songs that but I don't think of the crying as being sad. I think of it as just being hit with emotion. And I think for me anyway, you know, you can bury so much of it and you go about your day. He's got a song, Blood Brothers, you know, and that, you know, that you can get bogged down thinking like, what are we doing today? What are the bills we got to pay today? Right. But the music makes you remember what's important and then you forget it. And obviously, you know, you need it. You need the dose again and again, you got to go back to it. So which is for me, why it would be really hard to give up music because it does focus me on things that I think are important. Even if that focus only lasts for the 3 minutes and 25 seconds of the song, but that is a thing that music can do. And that these artists can do is make you feel for 3 minutes, really feel. And I think that's pretty special. Yeah.
Very well said.
Thank you, Ben. Ben, where can our listeners find The Plot Thickens coming up?
Anywhere you get podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get podcasts, it'll be there October 25th, maybe midnight on the 24th. I'm not sure how that works, but season four, Pam Grier, here comes Pam. And it's great. We're proud of it. And I think you'll like it too. And then, you know, you can follow me, you know, where to follow me on Twitter, you know, I'm basically retweeting Rex, but I show my wife videos and she's like, where do you get all this stuff? And I'm like, Rex, like that's all. I was just like, now she knows. I'm like, Rex, like, right. But if I didn't get it from Rex, I'm baffled. I don't know where I got it. Yeah.
So crazy, Ben. Thank you so much. Come back and do this again, please.
Anytime. Ask away. Thanks, guys.
Thanks,
buddy. Thank you. Between two turds.
Between two turds. Another episode in the books.
Yep. A smart guy surrounded by dummies.
By two turds.
Yeah.
Just, I can't believe we continue to get people that come on the show that are so smart and funny and interesting and worldly. I mean, I could have listened to him tell stories about Hollywood all day or politics, or I could listen to him read the phone book.
Yeah. He's great voice, great style, great attitude. Great. If you're watching the pod, he's got great hair. Oh yeah. He's got a real nice salad on him. He just looks great. and he's one of those guys. He says things and I have to lie. For no reason, like, you know, the director, Sim Flefla, but I'm like, sure. Yeah. Fantastic. Uh-huh. And he just sits and I'm just trying to keep up. I'm like, I know everything you're talking about. Please don't ask me.
I'm too smart to even interject too much. Anyway. Well, bud, it was great. And a bit of a turn for us, and I enjoyed it.
Yep, me too.
Immensely. All right, bud, let's do it again next week. Want to?
Sounds great to me.
Same time, same place for the Rex Chapman Show with my super dope homeboy from the Lex Town, Josh Hopkins, powered by basketballnews.com.